It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we travel to Eagle River to hear about the joys of pond hockey in an installment of Wisconsin Life.
First, a public hearing on Governor Walker's proposed state budget is taking place today in the city of Brilliant, a small community of around 3,000 residents in northeastern Wisconsin. It's the first in a series of four budget hearings around the state.
Public testimony got underway at around 10 o'clock this morning, scheduled to last until 5 p.m.
Here with us now to talk about what's been happening at today's hearing is Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter. Sean, thanks for being with us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
So you are at this very first public hearing on the budget. Set the scene for us. What are you seeing so far today?
Yeah, what it is it's kind of rapid fire testimony, which is the way it's been at these things for quite a few years. And they have time limits, 2-minute time limits. And so people get up there. I think the vast majority of people who testify know they're going to have time limits in advance. And so they've got these prepared remarks. So that they can get their statement in under time, and they just move fast from one person to the next. There's people waiting on deck, so you got a line of people waiting to testify. It's just one person after another, and you know it's fairly organized too, in that you have groups that have an interest in the budget, have learned to bring their people here to testify. And so they'll sign up early to testify. And so this morning, for example, you heard public school advocates make a big presence in the early going of the budget. And so you had public school administrators, school board members all testifying. And you've seen other interest groups, too, show kind of a presence here. But really moving fast. It's hard to imagine legislators absorbing all of this, but they say that every now and then there will be an issue that catches their attention that they didn't know about in advance.
You said people have a 2-minute time limit. Do you get the sense, sitting there watching this, that people would like to say more, be more expansive had they the time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people get cut off pretty regularly. Like I said, they are preparing their remarks to fit into that short time limit, so it happens less often than you'd think, but 2 minutes goes by real fast. Every now and then you'll have somebody who'll kind of open up and start to talk to members of the committee kind of off the cuff, joke around with them, try to be personable, and suddenly they realize they've eaten up about 1.5 minutes of their testimony and they've only got a few seconds left to go to talk about the point that they wanted to make when they got here. So it's, you know, it's kind of ridiculous in a way. It's got to be maddening if you've got this issue that's near and dear to you to get up there and try to sum it up in 2 minutes, but they do get through a lot of people this way. And, you know, it is something that Republicans and Democrats, going back to when Democrats were in charge of the legislature, have done with these time limits.
How many people would you say have attended the hearing so far?
I think there were 250 or so who had registered to speak, and that's not to say that they're all going to get a chance to speak or that they're all going to stick around, but about 250 or so, I think, had registered to speak. You've got people filing in and out of the auditorium all day. It's not packed. I mean, you can find a seat here if you want to in this auditorium at Brilliant High School, but pretty big crowd, and, I imagine that they will be going definitely until 5, which is when they're scheduled to close, and I think it may be that if you have registered to speak by 5, they'll take your testimony after that.
Now, you mentioned a lot of folks talking about the subject of education in the budget this morning. What else are you hearing as the day progresses?
Education was definitely the dominant theme, criticizing the governor's budget cut in the first year of the budget and continued revenue caps. But another theme that is definitely not partisan in nature is criticizing the governor's budget when it comes to long-term care for programs like family care and IRIS, community-based care programs that advocates say they like because it gives them some independence, lets them choose their care providers. And the governor's budget is moving away from those to more of a one-size-fits-all statewide insurance program, like an HMO program. Advocates don't like this. They didn't see it coming, they say. They're arguing that if we have to make big changes to our long-term care programs, we need to sit down with stakeholders and talk about what those are going to be, how they're going to affect people with disabilities. And they say that didn't happen with the governor's budget. And so you have not only the people who are providing that care coming here to testify, you have people who are receiving the care coming here to testify. And so you've got a lot of wheelchairs in the auditorium and some pretty emotional testimony there. That's one that's hard to explain, but definitely affects people's lives in a big way.
And when you see that emotional testimony, do you see any kind of reaction, maybe an emotional reaction from the legislators listening?
I will tell you they are less apt to cut off testimony when they see that, especially if it's someone with a disability who is having trouble formulating the words. They're listening. That's not one where they're saying, 2 minutes is up, let's move along. So there are some exceptions to the rule.
Now, you tweeted earlier that public administrators have dominated a bit of the day's discussion. What are they saying?
So the governor's budget, when it comes to education, it cuts state funding in the first year of the biennium, the two-year budget. And so what public school, not just administrators, but also school board members are saying is that we have had budget after budget now of state funding cuts. You know, one of the administrators said that his funding had been cut in half, his state funding had been cut in half since, by more than half since 2006. I mean, a lot of factors go into state aid. So, to sum that up is, just pure state budget cuts might not be accurate, but they have gone through a number of budgets now where their state aid has been cut, and their ability to make that up at the local level through property taxes has also been clamped down. So they've had these revenue caps put on them by the governor's budgets, and that happens again in this budget. So essentially, if they're in trouble and they need to have more property tax dollars to make up for those cuts and to operate, they have to go to referendum to do that. And they say that's just really no way to run a school system. So they have been, as they have been in budgets past, they've been one of the most organized lobbying forces at this public hearing. And there are lawmakers, I know, majority Republican lawmakers, who are sympathetic to that. And they're saying that if there's increased tax collections in May, that is if, tax collections come in faster than expected, they want to use some of that money first and foremost on public schools.
Now, before today's hearing, some lawmakers have been speaking out regarding the proposed cuts and changes to the UW system, including Representative John Nygren, who co-chairs the Joint Finance Committee. What's the latest there, and are you hearing about that at the hearing?
Yeah, you are hearing a little bit about it. It hasn't been quite as sustained of testimony as the public school advocates, which can just be a function of when they got here to sign up to testify, not necessarily a function of how much it affects people or the kind of heat there is behind the issue. But there have been people who've talked about the size of the cut being too big to absorb. And what Representative Nygren said today before the meeting was that he is working on a plan to get rid of the public authority that the governor proposed for the University of Wisconsin system. So this is the thing where the governor says, yes, I cut the budget, but I gave them this UW system authority. It would give them the opportunity to make more decisions, about how they run themselves. It looks like they're talking about phasing that out, Representative Nygren is. In addition to that, he says he is looking to give the system some more flexibilities to cut their own costs, including, he's also talking to the system about a tuition increase for out-of-state students to help soften some of those budget cuts. But he's not talking about taking new revenue and applying it to the University of Wisconsin system.
And we leave it there. Sean, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, you're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Eagle River claims it's the hockey capital of Wisconsin. Every year, more than 300 teams descend on the town to compete in the Pond Hockey Championship. Emily Bright caught up with members of a local team in the over 60 division known as the Eagle River Frozen Seven.
Rinks separated by snowbanks are packed in so close, it's hard to tell where fans' cheers and referees' whistles are directed. Bill Trozine is playing for his seventh year.
I think just coming out reminds you when you're a little kid. And just meeting the people from different places, different states, and there's so much energy and it's a nice party atmosphere.
A party that's 4-on-4, no goalie sticks, no stops. The teams who come here range from casual reunions of friends who used to play together in school to teams like the Eagle River Frozen Seven, a local team that plays 3 days a week in what's called the Noon League. Dave Hanselman is a regular of that group, though this year he's just watching.
Some real high-powered hockey going on. Some of these guys are really good, which is why I'm not playing this year. I think, okay, I'm 71, just a little bit too high-powered for me.
The Eagle River Frozen Seven competes in the over 60 division of the championships. Actually, there are two teams over age 60 coming from the same Noon Hockey League, which means fully one-third of that division is local.
There's no other game like this. I always tell people everything else is just exercise until hockey season starts.
Jim Patton is competing at age 75.
And actually, I mean, I like the idea that people can see you can still do this at that age. Everybody thinks about it being such a rough sport and you're always getting hurt. You don't have to be. I mean, you can play it for a long time.
Like most of the over 60s I talked to, Jim grew up playing pond hockey. He recalls being out on the lake every day after school, then coming home and playing boot hockey in the streets. And he remembers that first pond hockey championship 10 years ago.
The first year, on Friday, the temperature never got above 15 below zero. On Saturday morning, when we started playing, it was 27 below zero. Now we thought, oh my God, this is dead in the water right here. And I really believe that it actually helped us because I think everybody went back and bragged about, you can't believe what we played in and what we did, you know. And from that time on, it's just taken off like a skyrocket.
Now online registration fills up within 10 minutes of opening. Most of the teams who come once return, and the old-timers are in the minority. A few rinks over, a group of young women from Milwaukee playing their fifth pond hockey tournament celebrate by taking a special picture, a bride-to-be and the teammates who make up her bridal party. A player skates out on the rink with an extra-wide shovel to clear the ice for the next game. The Eagle River Frozen Seven beats their fellow local team, ice-aged, and is moving on to the semifinals. But when I ask the score, most people aren't sure. Says ice-aged player Bill Trozine.
If it gets close, you'll ask. But other than that, you just play hard till the whistle goes and everybody just has a great time. It's so much fun. We're like kids again.
One by one, the rinks clear out as teams are eliminated. The Eagle River Frozen Seven advances to the finals. They lose to the arch enemies of St. Louis by one goal, making this their third time coming in second. But there's plenty more winter left, which means that these men will be back in the hockey arena at noon three times a week, playing the game they love.
Catch more stories about sports and games throughout this month on Wisconsin Life.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org. During our coverage last week of the death of Tony Robinson, an unarmed, black, 19-year-old man who was shot by a white Madison police officer, questions arose for some listeners about diversity training for police officers.
To find out how that works, we've asked the Madison Police Department's Captain of Training, Tom Snyder, to join us for insight into how officers are trained. Captain Tom Snyder, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So what does this look like? What kind of diversity training do officers receive in your department?
Well, it depends when they've been hired. But for the last several years, I can tell you that we've spent about 50 hours devoted to topics in the Recruit Academy related to cultural competence, judgment under the radar, implicit bias, serving the mentally ill, and topics such as those. That's standard for all of our police recruits. In addition to that, we spend another about 30 hours on a topic known as professional communications. That's training where we allow officers to become better at their active listening skills, develop strategies for dealing with difficult circumstances, understanding the barriers to effective communication, and so on. Because this is obviously a job where communication is probably the number one skill that we can have.
You mentioned unrecognized racial bias. What kind of training is involved in trying to tackle unconscious bias that unconscious an officer might not be aware of coming in?
Absolutely. And we recognize that from the very get-go. We all have our own biases. We've been working with University of Wisconsin. One PhD candidate by the name of Patrick Forsher has been teaching at our police academy for the last several years. He discusses implicit bias. He takes new officers through an implicit bias test and exercises and really challenges our recruits to identify and understand how biases all affect us, because we understand that they do, and we have to be familiar with those biases.
Now, Tom, here's maybe an unconscious bias of my own, but I think, you know, based on years of police movies and TV shows, I might imagine the response of some officers being, great, another training, I got to get through it and then get back out on the job. What's the response from officers going through these various diversity trainings?
Well, that's a good point, and there's probably some truth to that. But, you know, I have to say, the Madison Police Department is a very unique agency among police departments. We're really best defined by who we are. We have recruits that average an age of 28 to 29 years old when they apply to our department. We have a very educated workforce. In fact, our next recruit class, all candidates will have a bachelor's degree, and about 20% have graduate degrees. So we're getting new officers ingrained into our department that have often, this is a second career. They've been doing other things. We have a very high percentage of women in our police department, the highest in the nation. So we're very conscious about who we recruit, how we recruit, and how we train these officers when they come to our department. So, again, it's not maybe your standard police department, but then Madison's not your typical city either. So we believe that we have a very well-educated, diverse workforce that represents the community. So, you know, maybe there'll be some people that roll their eyes at some training that we have, but I think we take it seriously here. We do for recruits as well as for the veteran officers that are on our department.
Now, these are trainings that happen, I imagine, in a meeting room, a conference room of some sort, maybe theoretical. Do you think these make a difference when police are out on the job responding to a call or patrolling in their neighborhood?
Absolutely. And we call them courageous conversations that we have about race. And I think that is very valuable to talk about these things. And like I said, so we know our biases, and we can problem solve, and we can put ourselves in situations. And one thing that is very important to us, and I think it's growing in the whole community, law enforcement community, is scenario-based training. We spend a significant amount of our time in the academy, as well as in more in-service type training, dealing with scenario situations where officers are expected to problem solve, they're expected to respond, they're expected to communicate, just like they would in the street, in the field, going to a call for service. So it's not just sitting in a classroom, it's actually doing something and engaging.
Now, you mentioned Madison being a unique city, but one thing it shares with a lot of Wisconsin, issues like achievement gaps between white and black students, disproportionate incarceration rates between white and black residents of the city, the county, and the state as a whole. How does that affect the police department's work in general and the training police officers receive?
Well, that's a very big question, and something I certainly can't answer in a short time, nor do I have the answer to that question. We recognize that. We know that there's a disparate impact in this community, in this county, and in the state in general when it comes to incarceration rates. That's something we spend a lot of time talking about in the academy. In fact, we have Dr. Prey from the Wisconsin Innocence Project who comes in and talks about the work of his organization. We have representatives from the Nehemiah organization who come in and talk to our judgment under the radar trainings and teach our officers the kind of work they do. So we are very conscious about these issues. you know, from your typical police officer's perspective in the city of Madison, we are so call driven. We're not out looking for problems. Problems seem to find us. We get called to scenarios. We get called to situations, and we're asked to resolve those in the best possible manner. So, it's a very complicated issue, and certainly something that it doesn't just affect the police department, but in the school system and housing, you name it. This is an issue that needs to be addressed.
Briefly, as we wrap up, a police-involved shooting here in Madison got a lot of national attention. Does this put a new focus for your department on these kinds of trainings?
Yes, it does, and I think it should. There's been a lot of media attention, as you speak of. There's public scrutiny of our police department, and to be honest, we understand that. We appreciate that. The community should be asking questions. There's a lot of questions asked about our curriculum, about our policies and procedures. The truth is, a lot of our use of force materials come directly from constitutional law, as well as the state training and standard mandates. We don't necessarily create some of those policies. Those are created for us at a state level, and we implement them. So there is some wiggle room there for the policies and procedures we come up with, but a lot of that is at a different level than your local police department.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today. That's Tom Snyder, captain of training with the Madison Police Department. He's been an officer there for 26 years.
There's a global race underway, one that's pitting nearly two dozen countries against each other. Their goal? To create the battery of the future, one that will power the next generation of cars and revolutionize the face of energy forever.
While developing a battery may not sound like the sexiest proposition, our next guest says there's a lot riding on this contest. The invention of a super battery could shake up big oil's grip on the world, propelling the winning country to the top of the world's superpowers, not to mention getting really rich along the way. So who all is chasing this goal? Who's working hard here in the U.S. to try to ensure that the winning country is going to be the U.S.?
Joining us now is Steve Levine. He's Washington correspondent for Quartz Magazine and the author of the new book, The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Steve, how would you explain what exactly is at stake here in the race to develop the battery of the future?
It's a race that's going on numerous levels. The stakes are very, very high on all of them, just on the very most mundane level, everyday level, affecting everyone who's on the air. That it's about making our electricity bills in our homes much lower than they are right now. It's about paying a lot less for the gasoline for how much it costs to drive our cars. But when you get on a grand scale, the biggest scale of all, it will affect geopolitics. It's going to, when this super battery is built, it's going to make certain countries a lot weaker, and it's the same countries that have been powerful over the last few decades because of their oil. That's Russia and OPEC and so on. And it's going to make the country where that super battery is built much wealthier, much more powerful.
Now, on a global scale, who are the players in this race?
Well, the United States is in the race. China's in the race, of course. That won't surprise you. But Japan, South Korea are the biggest players right now because they've been making batteries. They've been on the cutting edge of this for a couple of decades right now. But in all, when I started writing the book, I did just a Google search on how many countries are in the race either to create the super battery or to own the electric car space. And when I got to 20, I stopped. Almost every country of any size that has any economy is trying to have a big piece of this future.
So a lot of countries have a horse in this race, but any indications right now who's looking to take the lead?
Yeah, well, as I was saying, the countries that have the lead are Japan and South Korea. This, again, it won't surprise you that they are in that position despite the fact that all of the batteries that were that are in use right now, the in electronics, in our smartphones, in our cars, were invented in by Americans in the United States. An American invented the lithium-ion battery, but also its precursor, the nickel metal hydride battery. But we didn't have the vision. Our manufacturers, our companies didn't have the vision to manufacture them, to take the risk over years and years of learning how to cut costs and productize them and put them onto the market. Japan did. So you have Japan and South Korea are in the lead. The United States decided about 5 years ago in the wake of the financial crash. We're floundering around about what's going to be the next big industry. A lot of players in the United States, private players, and also the government decided we were going to be in the race. At about the same time, China decided it was going to be so too. So as we see it right now, Japan, South Korea in the lead, with the U.S. having really superb inventive power. We're very, very good in the laboratory, being a very strong player, and China being a strong player simply because it has a record of being able to own the industries that it wants to own.
Well, to get us up to speed on the technology a bit, we should maybe look back a little bit at the history of battery technology. How much has the technology changed between the battery's invention and now?
Well, this again is a surprising thing. If just think about it, when do you think that the battery was invented? When you ask that question, you know, people, you know, they'll come up with a number 100 years ago, you know, sometime this century, but it was invented over 200 years ago, 1799. And the architecture of that battery that Alessandro Volta invented in Italy is not much different from the one that you see inside your smartphone, this stacked approach to the battery. And in fact, the lead-acid battery that's inside everyone's car, that was invented in 1859. Mm. And the cutting-edge batteries, the lithium-ion battery, was invented in 1980, 35 years ago. And so they've been around for a long time. The structure has been the same. What's happened, though, over the last five or so years, is that a sort of a mental switch has occurred around the world, and including the United States, and that's that we don't just need batteries. We don't just need something that's going to allow us to carry around a smartphone in our pocket. We need a battery that's going to allow us to enable the electric car. And enable means that not that Elon Musk can have a 265-mile car that costs $100,000, but that either he or another car maker will be able to market an electric car that everyone can afford, you know, $25,000, let's say, and that will enable solar and wind, so and to reduce how much natural gas and coal need to be burned during peak hours of use. And so you know, about 2009, 2010, at a simultaneous period around the world, everyone kind of understood that we need to get on the case, and that's the beginning of the race.
Well, it's interesting from what you said. It sounds as though a lot of the batteries that we still use today were invented, you know, a really long time ago. So why is it that in the age of technological explosion in so many other areas, battery technology seems like it's kind of creeping along?
Yeah, this is right. This is right. So the same time that we have two Voyager spacecraft that are tooling along outside the solar system right now. And you know, our smartphones double in power, in performance, every year and a half. But the battery has crawled along like a snail. That's because not all sciences and not all technologies operate according to the general understanding of how they do. We're operating on a myth. I use this term, the Apollo myth. We think that just because we've declared a stretch goal, thrown some money at it, a lot of money even, and a deadline, that our ingenious scientists are going to reach that goal. Some tasks that have incredibly high stakes, like this one, that we really have to accomplish, are super hard. And one way to understand how hard they are is to think about them not like the silicon wafer or like Apollo, but like one of those 19th century math puzzles. Every now and then you read in the newspaper about some grizzled, eccentric mathematician in some corner of some library, dusty stack of books, who somehow has resolved a mathematics problem that's been around for centuries. This is what the battery is. That is how hard it is and will be, and how surprising the breakthrough will be when it happens.
Well, we're talking right now with author and journalist Steve Levine about the race to create the battery of the future. And you can join the conversation.
What do you think a new battery technology could mean, will mean for the world? Would you buy an electric car that promised 300 miles before needing a recharge if its cost was in the neighborhood of the internal combustion cars we have out there? What questions do you have about this race to build a new technology, the battery of the future? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Steve Levine, author of The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. And we're taking your comments and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take a caller now. We've got Chad joining us first in Eau Claire. Chad, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you think?
I'm wondering, because the batteries developments and there's still going to have to be recharged, so we're going to have to generate electricity, and I'm wondering how that's going to reduce fossil fuels, coal plants, and things like that, if we have to generate the electricity to recharge these batteries.
Okay, Chad, thanks. I think I got your question there, and Stevie's asking, if we've got to recharge these batteries anyway, we're still going to need to use fuel to do that, aren't we? So where does the net savings come?
That's right. First, this is a very good question. To the degree that we're burning coal to create that electricity that then you use to charge up the battery, there is no net improvement. To the degree that we're using natural gas or nuclear power, to the degree that solar and wind over the coming decade and more comprise more of the power that we're producing, that's where you get your impact. In terms of the climate change, the lowering of greenhouse gases. So the country, the United States, and really a lot of the world are moving away from coal, and they're moving toward natural gas. And so really that trend line is already headed in the right direction.
And Steve, briefly, so we can get back to the callers, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the Argonne National Laboratory, a place doing a lot of the heavy lifting to build a super battery, kind of a secretive place. What sort of research are they doing there?
Right. So So this is very, very important. I'm glad you brought that up. So I became fixated, you know, and thrilled by the, by all of the stakes, all the points that we've just made until now. But I did not want to write the book from a 50,000 foot view, sort of a policy book. If I was going to write the story of the battery, what I wanted to do was sit with America's team that was trying to make this breakthrough. I wanted to spend a year with them. And just, it's so hard to do this. Why is it so hard? What do they have to do? Who are these people? What makes them tick? And the place that I found that, that houses the closest thing to America's team in this race is at Argonne, Argonne National Lab, which is outside Chicago. It's one of the 17 federally funded national labs. There are about around the world between a dozen and two dozen recognized battery geniuses. Two of them are at Argonne. Their stuff that they invented is in the Chevy Volt, so it's already been commercialized, and they are a fascinating bunch. It's a thrilling place to be. One eccentricity about America's team in the battery race is they're almost all foreign born. They're from Africa. The two geniuses are from Africa, one from Morocco and one from South Africa. A lot of them are Chinese and Indian as well too, meaning that if the U.S. wins this race, it's going to be nationalities that are on the opposing teams often who will do so. And every day when they go into work, they think that if they're successful, they're going to save the world. That's where the title of the book comes from. Their attitude is their job, unlike most of our jobs, are that if they are successful, they can save the world.
And Steve, when we talk about this battery of the future, is this a question of if or a question of when? I mean, is there any doubt that this thing could actually come to fruition?
There are doubts. It's a very hard thing. One of the fascinating aspects of the story is that one of the chief tensions is can and will they succeed? I argue, and I think it's indisputable that the stakes are so high and the payoff, if they're successful, so high that we have to be in it. That's why everyone is in this race. But it doesn't mean someone is going to succeed in our lifetimes. I personally think that they will. I think that we're not very far away. There are signs before the end of the decade we're going to get close, very, very close to having cars of the way it's been described on this show that would be side by side comparable with the combustion engine. But what's happening is that because of the stakes and the payoff, you're having the players using just a number of methods, a lot of methods trying to get there.
Steve, fascinating story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Steve Levine, author of the new book, The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World.